Mr. Mayfield, I think you may proceed whenever you're ready, and we are hearing California against Ramos.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the respondent was sentenced to death for first-degree murder during the commission of a robbery. He robbed the on-duty employees at a fast-food restaurant where he worked, after which he shot both of them in the head, and one of them lived. He was convicted of two counts of robbery, attempted murder, and murder of the first degree, along with a special allegation that the murder was committed during the commission of the robbery. Under the California Penal Code, murder of the first degree is punishable by 25 years to life unless certain special circumstances are alleged and found true beyond a reasonable doubt, in which case the alternative penalties are death or life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. The penalty is determined at a separate hearing in which the trier of fact is a jury unless waived by both parties. At that separate hearing, both parties may present additional evidence, and the statute provides for certain specified aggravating and mitigating factors which the jury must consider, in addition to an additional catch-all factor permitting the jury to consider any factor in mitigation. If the aggravating circumstances outweigh mitigating circumstances, the jury is required to return a verdict of death. If mitigating circumstances outweigh aggravating circumstances, the jury is required to return a verdict of life imprisonment without possibility of parole. The judge, trial judge, may modify a verdict of death to one of life without possibility of parole, although if the jury returns the lesser punishment, it cannot be increased. The statute also requires that the trier of fact be instructed that the punishment of life imprisonment without possibility of parole may in future be modified by the governor to include a lesser sentence which permits the possibility of parole. In this case, defense counsel objected to that instruction being given on the ground that it violated his right to due process of law, and the trial judge overruled the objection on the ground it was required by statute. On automatic appeal to the California Supreme Court, the court expressly and exclusively reversed the death penalty on the ground that the portion of the statute which required the giving of that instruction violated the defendant's right to due process under the 5th, 8th, and 14th Amendments for two reasons. One, that it introduced an extraneous factor into the jury's deliberations, and second, that it was misleading because it did not require an instruction, because the instruction did not inform the jury that the governor could also commute a sentence of death to a lesser sentence. The issue presented on certiorari to this court is whether enforcement of that statutory provision requiring the instruction violates the 5th, 8th, and 14th Amendments. This court's cases indicate that due process is violated whenever a defendant is deprived of some guaranteed right, or if a procedure is fundamentally unfair. In the capital cases, which sort of blend 5th, so 14th, and 8th Amendment principles, cases have held that a procedure which increases the likelihood of an arbitrary or capricious or unreliable sentencing determination may violate due process. There's a basic distinction this court has drawn between capital cases and others on the ground that the death sentence is unique in its finality. Subsidiary question. Under the question presented on certiorari, since this is a state statutory procedure, is the question whether the statute clearly and unmistakably violates the defendant's due process rights. In the California's alternative sentences, the sentence of death, the meaning is quite clear. If that sentence is carried out, the defendant will be put to death. On the other hand, the sentence, the alternative sentence of life without possibility of parole, is not literally accurate, because it does not mean that if that sentence is imposed, the defendant must inevitably be perpetually imprisoned until death.
Mr. Mayfield, is the phrase life imprisonment without possibility of parole a word of art in California jurisprudence or something to that effect?
It is, Your Honor, in the sense that it does not literally mean what it says. In California law, a sentence of life imprisonment permits a consideration for parole after 7 years. The sentence of life imprisonment without possibility of parole for murder wasn't available in California until 1977. Previously, that sentence was only imposed on certain aggravated forms of kidnapping.
That was by referendum.
Initiative. Yes, Your Honor, similar.
It wasn't debated or anything.
Yes, Your Honor, there was
well, it
public
wasn't debated
debate
in the legislature.
No, Your Honor, not in the legislature.
Is there any possibility of parole for a person who's sentenced to life without possibility of parole?
Yes, Your Honor, there is.
He can be paroled.
He can be paroled because of the statutory and constitutional provisions for the governor to commute his sentence.
Is a commutation by the governor considered a parole?
The governor can commute the
can
sentence.
Can the governor put him on parole?
No, Your Honor.
So that the life sentence without possibility of parole is really accurate, isn't it? Because he can't be paroled.
No, Your Honor, it's not accurate.
Parole is quite different from a commutation of a sentence, is it not?
Yes, Your Honor. The sentence may be commuted to a sentence which includes the possibility of parole.
It may just be commuted to a sentence of life imprisonment.
Yes, sir. Or it may be commuted to a sentence of 25 years to life.
In which event the parole would be a possibility.
Yes, sir. That's the term without possibility of parole is on its face misleading because it is not literally true that a person given this sentence may never be paroled.
Incidentally, did I understand you to say that a death sentence, too, may be commuted by the governor to a parole?
It may be commuted by the governor to a sentence of life without possibility of parole or
life sentence.
Yes,
so
that's correct.
In the latter instance, he also could be admitted to parole.
That's correct.
There's any difference between the governor's considering commutation or life without parole and a death penalty. They're both done the same way by the governor, man.
Not necessarily.
I mean, are there different standards or criteria or anything?
The governor can set his own criteria, although for individuals sentenced to life without parole, there are provisions within the Department of Corrections regulations for them to consider and make recommendations. There's also a vast difference in that there's relatively a small window for the governor to commute a death sentence. During this period, after all the appeals have expired and a period when the sentence is to be carried out. On the other hand, every individual who is in prison under a sentence of life imprisonment without parole always retains the possibility that he may be commuted and not spend the rest of his life in prison.
Mr. Mayfield, did the Supreme Court of California in its analysis of the federal constitutional question differentiate between the first and the second sentence of the so-called Briggs instruction?
No, Your Honor.
The reason let me read you the first sentence, which you're doubtless very familiar with. You're instructed that under the state constitution, a governor is empowered to grant a reprieve, pardon, or commutation of a sentence following conviction of a crime. That's simply a statement of fact, isn't it? The governor could commute a death sentence, he could commute a life sentence without parole, he could commute any sentence.
That's correct.
Did the Supreme Court of California feel that instruction was misleading?
No, I believe not. What they believe what was misleading is the fact that that is merely, I believe, a lead-in to the operative part of the instruction, which says that a sentence of life imprisonment without parole may be modified.
Well, the instruction has two sentences in it. At least the California Supreme Court did not object to the first of the two sentences.
I believe the California Supreme Court objects to the entire instruction because of the view that any part of the instruction puts an extraneous factor into the jury's consideration.
So you think its holding extends to holding the first sentence of the instruction unconstitutional on federal constitutional grounds?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe so.
So you'd get the same result if the instruction said the governor may commute any sentence, including a sentence of death.
I believe so.
That's essentially what the instruction says, doesn't it?
What the first part of the instruction
governor
doesn't differentiate.
The governor can commute anything, and including a death sentence.
It does, in fact, say that, but it doesn't specifically refer to the death sentence, whereas the second part of the instruction does. From the standpoint of the alternatives offered, I believe it's reasonable to consider that the determination by a sentencer will in some way be affected by the sentencer's perception of the alternatives that he's choosing between. For example, in Beck versus Alabama, where the jury could only return a verdict of guilty of a capital offense, even though there was evidence from which a lesser offense could be returned, this court found that that would skew the determination. I believe that the determination of the jury's verdict could be skewed also if the jury believed that the difference between the alternative punishments is minimal. For instance, it would be impermissible under the California statute for a juror who was convinced that aggravating circumstances outweighed mitigating circumstances to impose a sentence of life imprisonment without possible parole because he believed that was a more severe sentence. Probably not too many people may think that, but I suggest there are some. Similarly, it would be impermissible under the California statute for a juror who was convinced that mitigating circumstances outweighed aggravating circumstances to impose the punishment of death because he thought he was doing the defendant a favor. In this case, the defendant himself at least told his psychiatrist that he'd rather have the death penalty than life without parole. there is a probability that a large percentage, a substantial percentage of jurors, will be aware of California law and will, in any event, realize that there is a power of commutation of sentences of life without parole, that there is the possibility of parole. But I think it's reasonable for California to decide that it's preferable if every juror in every case is aware of that by manner of a simple instruction which tells them this fact. When we speak of reliability of sentencing determinations, I think that consistency is of some significance. As to the other part of the California Supreme Court's decision that the instruction is misleading, I believe it's significant that trial counsel below didn't make that argument. And I suggest the reason possibly is set forth in the California Supreme Court's decision in People v. Morse back in 60 Cal 2nd, where they said, since people probably know something about parole, you should tell the jury that there is a possibility of parole, but tell them that's not supposed to be what they base the decision on. They shouldn't take that into consideration. On the other hand, you should not tell a jury about the power of the trial judge or the California Supreme Court or the governor to commute a sentence of death.
Was that earlier decision you're referring to, Mr. Mayville, based on federal constitutional grounds?
No, that was based on the view of what it was a good idea to tell.
What the highest court of any state might do in reviewing jury instructions given in that state.
Yes, but this was not based on federal constitutional grounds, because the rationale for that was they said that if you tell the jury that someone else might change their death penalty decision, that may lessen their sense of responsibility for this awesome thing they're going to do in imposing the death penalty. And I suggest that very rarely would a trial counsel want to have that instruction given. The only conceivable reason, if he thought that aggravating circumstances were so overwhelming that he wanted to convince the jury it made no difference.
Mr. Mayfield, may I ask you a question? The red brief has in it a table telling us how often the California governors have actually commuted death sentences. Is there anything before us that tells us how often California governors have commuted life sentences without possibility of parole?
At page 4, I believe, of the opposition to the petition for certiorari, the counsel, I believe, set forth a list over a period of some years. There had been 41 death sentences commuted and 24 life without parole during that period.
In what period was that?
I don't recall the exact
24
period.
Over some several-year period.
Yes, a period of quite a number of years.
In your view, would the defendant be entitled to have the judge tell that to the jury, that this possibility had actually occurred only 24 times in the past 20 years or whatever the figure is?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because I don't think that tells very much.
Well, but doesn't it tell more than the Briggs instruction tells?
It does, but I think perhaps expansion would, in fact, invite speculation. The one thing this instruction does is remove what is an otherwise misleading connotation that the difference between these two sentences, death and life without the possibility of parole may appear to some to be minimal when they are not.
But Mr. Mayfield, supposing your 24 examples are 24 out of 24,000, I don't know how many sentences this kind of put in effect, but if in 99 and 99 one-hundredths percent of the cases it is in fact life without possibility of parole, how misleading is it?
Oh, it would not be misleading, but the fact remains that the possibility of commutation for life without possibility of parole remains. It isn't just you didn't get commuted now, so you're all through. Everyone who's in prison now has that possibility.
Well, I suppose you might tell them about the possibility of escape then too. I mean, it's equally frequent, isn't it?
I think not, Your Honor. I suggest that if California had chosen to eliminate the sentence of life imprisonment without possibility of parole and tell the jury to select between 25 years to life and death, that the jury would know that the defendant at some time could be released from prison, and it would not, in that case, be necessary to inform the jury that the death penalty could be commuted. And I believe that California's decision that it may make for a more reliable and consistent decisions to inform the jury accurately of the meaning of this sentence does not violate any guaranteed right of the defendant, or does not make the decision fundamentally unfair to him or otherwise arbitrary or capricious.
How many other cases are likely to be affected by a decision in this case?
I don't know the exact number. I think about 30.
Somewhere in the record I had seen a figure of 90, but is that another category?
That was the number of cases, I believe, that had been perhaps tried under the
1978 statute.
Yes, I can't say where the justice got that figure, but my survey indicates about 30 may be affected. I would like to save the rest of my time for you.
Mr. Hendon.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. This case involves a unique provision. There is no other statute like it in the country, containing a provision which has been universally condemned in virtually every state jurisdiction that has been called upon to pass on it, and which...
Well, then I misunderstood your first statement.
Well, there is no other statute like it. The issue of whether commutation can go to a jury in the absence of a statute has been resolved in somewhere around 28 state court jurisdictions. 24 of those 28 state courts have ruled that the issue of commutation in any form cannot go to a jury in the penalty phase of a sentence.
Well, that may be true, but on state grounds?
No, I think...
Is it supervisory or
federal
grounds?
Many of them are cases which precede this Court's decisions in Furman. However, there are a number of recent ones which have been cited in the briefs, and there are more every day. In addition to those cited in the briefs, there are two that have come down another one out of Illinois called People versus Szabo, which was decided on January 24th of 1983, and another out of Maryland called Poole versus Maryland, which was decided on January 7th, 1983.
All 26 of those cases, capital cases?
No, they're not. However, I personally think it's if a jury in a non-capital case, in a jury which has a sentencing function, in a non-capital case cannot hear about commutation, then a fortiori it cannot hear about it in a capital.
Does it make a difference where the trial is bifurcated?
Well, only to the extent that it may be more prejudicial for a jury in a unitary proceeding to hear about it. Conceptually, I think that's just a management problem. I think theoretically and conceptually it should make no difference.
Mr. Hendon, you said that there were some 20-odd state cases involving instructions like this. Were they perfect counterparts of the California instruction? Do they have the first sentence as it is?
Yes, they're even more fair than the California instruction, because our contention is that the California instruction in its present form is misleading because it involves partial disclosure.
Do you think the first part, the first sentence is misleading?
Yes, Your Honor, I do, because I don't frankly read it the same way you do. The way I read it, it says you're instructed that under the state constitution, a governor is empowered to grant a reprieve, pardon, or commutation of a sentence following conviction of a crime. It doesn't say any sentence, doesn't say all sentences.
Well, but certainly the use of the Article A is a very indefinite article.
A is, my grammar is not what it should be, but I think it's a definite. I think it's a particular sentence. It doesn't, there's at least ambiguity of whether it's saying all sentences. A sentence and all sentences are not the same logically or grammatically, I think.
What is the reasoning of the state courts who have held, how many did you say there were who've held this invalid on a federal constitutional ground?
I think if you examine the reasoning behind the state court decisions, they go off on grounds which are ultimately federal constitutional grounds. Now, they may have preceded Furman so that they're not couched in constitutional terms, but the logic and the reasoning is that the issue of commutation, even when the issue of commutation is put before the jury even-handedly, even when a jury is told that the governor can commute both a life without parole sentence and a death sentence, which this instruction does not do, but when the issue is put before the jury even-handedly, that injects a level of speculation into the jury's sentencing phase, which renders any decision it may return unreliable and which diverts it from its primary task, which is, after all, what? It is to decide whether this individual, in light of this crime, should die.
How many of the state decisions are expressly couched in federal constitutional terms?
Of the recent one, well,
of all of them.
Of all of them.
There are 28. Or...
I can think of three offhand. The recent, the most recent Illinois case, I believe Poole versus Maryland is federal constitutional, and I think the Louisiana case, Lindsay, is. There are two reasons why this provision, I think, this particular provision, cannot pass constitutional muster. First, it affirmatively misleads a jury in the penalty phase of a capital case as to the nature of its function and the consequences of its decision. And secondly, as I've alluded to, it injects a level of speculation and uncertainty into the penalty decision which cannot be tolerated in a capital case and which deflects the jury from its true task. What does this statute do? It tells a jury, in effect, you have two choices here. You can sentence to life without parole or you can sentence to death. But you should bear in mind that life without parole does not mean life without parole. That the governor can commute life without parole. And I may say, in passing, in response to the question that Justice Rehnquist asked, that the term life without parole is no more a term of art in the state of California than is the term death.
What was the inception of this constitutional or this initiative? You know, someone must have been bothered by something that happened.
Yes, I think that the purpose of this initiative was to overrule the case of People versus Morse, which told the jury, what the case of People versus Morris did was to tell the jury, look, you may speculate about issues such as parole or commutation, and I, the judge, will tell you about parole and commutation so that you will know what the truth is and so that you will not speculate. But Morse goes on and says, it would be a violation of your oaths as jurors if you were to consider this factor in rendering your decision. Your decision is to be based upon the facts of the case and the circumstances of the crime and on nothing else.
You're going a little bit too far. What about a juror who knows this?
Who knows?
What about a juror who voted for this law? Yeah. Obviously, he'd know about it. Would he be ineligible to sit as a juror? You see, you went so far to say he shouldn't know about it.
No, my only position is, my position...
You don't have to go there.
No, I don't, and I don't, I didn't mean
That's
to
That's all
go
I'm
there.
Trying to get to.
Yes, well, you're perfectly correct. I didn't, if I left the impression that I was going that far, then I take it back, because I don't mean to.
The question then be asked at voir dire, do you know about this? Anybody who knows about it should be off the jury.
You see, the way the states, the issue on which the states split is not whether a jury can know about commutation. That's not the issue in this case, and I think it needs to be clearly understood that that's not the issue in this case. The issue in this case is whether a jury can consider commutation and parole. There are many states which say, as Morse did originally, you may speculate about this. You may speculate about parole. You may speculate about commutation. Here is the truth about it. You cannot consider it. Okay. And that's all we're involved in this case. All we're involved in is the question of whether the jury can consider it.
You think the federal Constitution may require a rule that says even though we tell you something, you can't consider what we're telling you?
I think the federal Constitution requires that there be an assurance that a jury in a capital case does not predicate its decision on unreliable, speculative information which deflects it from its constitutionally mandated task. And yes, I think that
Mr. Hendon,
while it may be permissible to inform them about it so that they don't speculate about it, some prophylactic measure has to be taken so that they don't predicate the decision on it. Excuse me.
Perhaps you've already answered this, but if so, I missed it. Would you be here if the instruction also covered the capital punishment?
Yes.
Why?
Because in that event, which is a question that the court need not reach in this case, but in that event, the issue of commutation would still be before the jury. The jury could still take into account the fact that a governor could commute a death sentence, for example. And to the extent that it took that into account, it would be taking into account the utterly unknowable. What a California governor, perhaps a governor who has not even been elected yet, may do someday in the future is obviously something that no sitting juror can know about.
Well, would you be satisfied if if any reference to commutation were eliminated from the instruction?
Yes, I would. And that is the effect.
Even though jurors who know about this power are not told not to consider it.
Well, the state law is, and it's.
So your part of your submission is not that there must be an instruction
not
to consider.
No, only that if there is one, that some steps must be taken to make sure that it's not being considered by the jury. In other words, to tell a jury something that it may speculate about.
If this instruction went on and said exactly, if this instruction were the same except you had appended to it, but you should not consider this.
Right. As difficult
that would be all right. You wouldn't be here.
I'm not going to make that representation. I would have.
Well, you might be here on some other case.
That's right.
Maybe you have no choice. You're the respondent anyway.
That's right. No, I would have a much more difficult argument. I would have the argument, you know, the skunk in the jury box argument. You put a skunk in the jury box and then tell the jury not to smell it. You know, is this the kind of information that a jury really could be asked to disregard? It's an issue that's not presented in this case. It's not one that the court needs to reach, and I would suggest that the court not reach it. I think we need to talk a little bit about what a jury is being asked to consider when it is being asked to consider commutation. It's being asked to consider what is perhaps the most wide-ranging, open-ended, untrammeled power that an executive can have. This court's opinions over and over and over again, and California opinions over and over again, have made clear that the power of the governor to commute is virtually unlimited. He can do so for any reason he sees fit at almost any time that he sees fit. And in point of fact, as the chart which Justice Stevens alluded to makes clear, California governors have exercised that power as they saw fit in terms of their political view, their political perspective of what is an appropriate case to commute, taking into consideration all of the political, essentially non-judicial decision factors that go into a decision to pardon or to commute. And to ask a jury to somehow factor that in to the penalty phase of a capital case is to ask it to do the impossible. It is to ask it to consider information which is the essence of speculation, the essence of uncertainty. And I suggest it's not possible. It's essentially unreliable. It also, I suggest, deflects the jury from the task that it is set forth to do, which whether a governor is going to commute a sentence has absolutely nothing to do with Marcelino Ramos as far as the jury is concerned. A, they'll never know whether the governor is going to commute him, and B, if he does, he can do so, as I've said, for any reason he sees fit. There have been governors in this country who have commuted all death sentences. I believe Winthrop Rockefeller, before he left office in Arkansas, commuted all death sentences and cleaned out death row. This was a political decision that he made. It had nothing to do with who was on there. It was within his power to do so. President Andrew Johnson has commuted all sentences of all secessionists. This was a political decision which he was free to make for what reasons he makes. And I suggest respectfully to the court that when we come to the point where juries in the most serious case, which the criminal law at least knows, are making their decisions not on the basis of what they may think is appropriate in terms of this individual and this crime, his background, what he did and why he did it, not on that basis, but on the basis of what some future governor may do in the exercise of a power which he exercises pursuant to considerations which are wholly alien to judicial consideration.
Do you really think you can generalize that way about why governors, what motivates governors to exercise the commutation power? Some governors have ad hoc advisory committees to advise them. Some do it on the basis of some newly discovered factor. Do you really think there's any basis for generalizing as you have?
Well, I think that makes my point, with all due respect. There is no basis for generalizing, and therefore there is no basis on which a jury could generalize.
Johnson, Andrew Johnson, and Governor Rockefeller of Arkansas,
yes,
certainly did purely political.
Yes.
But that doesn't mean that commutations generally are based on political considerations.
No, they may not be, but they can be. And when they are, they don't focus on the facts of the case. And when they do focus on the facts of the case, they focus on the governor's view of the facts of the case. The jury is told nothing about the governor's view of the facts of the case.
Still not correct. Governor Doyle had a commission, and he, at the last date, would put his own lawyer to work on the case until every lead had been run down. You wouldn't call that political, would you?
Well, what I mean by political, historically, perhaps I'm not using the word correctly. Historically,
non-judicial.
Yes, non-judicial. historically, the power of commutation stems from the power of the sovereign to dispense grace. The sovereign could dispense grace for
political reasons or any other reasons.
Or any other reasons that he saw fit, yes. Finally,
maybe, as has happened, because the governor has conscientious objections to the death penalty, per se.
Absolutely.
That very likely was true with the Arkansas situation.
Absolutely. I agree. And to inject, my point is to inject that into the penalty phase of a capital case is to inject a standardless, arbitrary factor in, which gets us back to the state of the law.
But
no
one is asking the jury to apply a standardless, arbitrary. You're just being told as a juror that there is such a standardless, arbitrary factor in existence.
This statute puts the issue of commutation before the jury for its consideration.
But it doesn't ask the jury to commute or to exercise political judgment to assess the penalty.
No, but it puts it before the jury as a factor for the jury's consideration.
But it is a fact.
Yes, but how does the jury account for that fact?
Well, how do they account for lots of facts that they find?
Classic instance in which you're going to have two juries with differing views of when a governor, perhaps an as yet unelected governor, is going to exercise the power of commutation, coming back with different verdicts in cases which would otherwise be the same.
Well, how about considering, as some death penalty statutes allow, the possibility of rehabilitation of this particular defendant?
Well, but that's
a relatively standardless judgment, too.
Well, but it's a factor that's tied to the defendant in the case. It proceeds from an assessment of the evidence that has been put before this jury, tied to this person. What is the likelihood, in the light of his life, his background, his crime, his family, all of those factors, that this is an individual who can be rehabilitated?
Well, isn't it entirely possible that if some of them have members of the jury had their civics courses within 10 years before the time of their jury service, they will remember that governors have that kind of commutation power? And then are you not dependent on having one or several jurors give some supplemental instructions to the jury about the commutation power in the course of their deliberations?
It is possible that jurors would know about commutation. It is possible,
isn't it,
that
very likely that some of them will know out of 12 members of a jury?
Yes, I would say that it might be likely that some of them would know about it. I would agree with that. I don't know.
As they might know that he could commute the death penalty.
They might.
This is why I still don't understand why you draw a line between the two. Had this jury been instructed that whether they impose the capital offense or the capital penalty on the one hand or death, life without parole on the other, the governors still have the power to commute in either case, why is that prejudicial to your client?
Because if a jury thinks about what's going to go on in the mind of a juror when he or she thinks about the power of the governor to commute a death sentence, he's going to think one possible psychology, which has been commonly referred to, is somebody else is going to be looking over my shoulder. If I make a mistake, it's not so bad. There'll be somebody looking at it who can possibly correct it. And a juror should not constitutionally be permitted that. A juror should resolve for herself whether this
is the situation, doesn't it?
No, it eliminates that defect, yes. It balances the situation, but it does not address the question of what kind of information can be before a jury for its consideration so that we wind up with consistent.
Of course, then you run into the Chief Justice's question. Somebody may know it from the civics course anyway. And this you cannot prevent.
No, you cannot. You can only do your best. You know, you cannot absolutely prevent it, and we're not faced in this case with the question of whether there needs to be an affirmative instruction.
Well, but given these various imponderables, such as jurors knowing it from civics class or perhaps having voted for or against this particular initiative, wouldn't it be fair to say that the state ought to be entitled to the very wide latitude in making decisions as to what kind of facts go before the jury and what don't, that it isn't simply only one particular set of instructions would pass constitutional muster.
No, I agree with that, and I don't contend otherwise. And the issue, if this were a case in which the instruction said to the jurors, here's the governor's power to commute life without parole sentences, here is the governor's power to commute death sentences, you are instructed not to consider these factors. They're not relevant for you in coming to the task which the Constitution and the law imposes upon you. We would have a very different case.
Well, what if they said everything but the last, or everything but your familiar, you are not to consider?
Well, then I think the presumption has got to be that they're considering it.
Supposing it is, what's wrong with that constitutionally?
Because there is no way that a jury can factor that in to its decision in a way which satisfies the repeated injunction of this court's cases since Furman that death penalties, that a state must take extraordinary measures, I believe was Justice O'Connor's language in Eddings, must go to extraordinary measures in order to ensure that death sentences are not returned on the basis of arbitrariness, caprice, or mistake.
Well, do you think it's less likely that a jury, given this instructions, will return an arbitrary verdict than if a jury, which is given no instruction, goes out to the jury room, three of the people have voted for this initiative, four of them voted against it, two others know something about the commutation power. They probably each have a somewhat different perception about it, and the jury argues about it in that context.
Your Honor, that's not this case. You know,
no,
you're posing to me the situation, as I understand your question, you're posing to me the situation where the choice is between an instruction which tells them about it and tells them to disregard it, or this instruction.
No, I'm posing no instruction, which I take is what you would pose.
No, I'm saying that no instruction may pass constitutional muster. Okay, that's all.
It seems to me you're putting the state courts a power to instruct in these cases in a very narrow bind on the federal Constitution, given the fact that courts are constantly wondering, well, jurors probably already know this. Should I instruct on it? Should I not? Not just in this area, but lots of others. And to now, I don't think it's been thought the federal Constitution had a preference one way or the other, so long as the state court was reasonably fair about the thing.
No, I think the federal Constitution makes very clear the nature and quality of the information that can go before a sentencer in a capital case. I think in Gardner versus Florida, this court ruled that potentially unreliable information by a judge in that case, potentially unreliable information, put before a judge under a statute which this court had otherwise previously upheld as constitutional in Proffitt versus Florida, required a remand for resentencing, for a new sentencing hearing. This court has gone to great lengths to ensure that a part of the capital sentencing decision is not arbitrary, unknowable, speculative information. Many, many things happen after the jury returns a verdict of death. There is review by the state's highest court. Should a jury be told about that? They may speculate about that. There's escape. People die in prison. People are killed in prison. Many, many things can happen. It strikes me that the system only works, and the Constitution requires for the system to work, that jurors do their duty. Their duty is to do what they think is right based on the facts of the case, and to assume that other duly constituted authority will do its job. The governor will do his job, the jury does its job, the Supreme Court does its job. It works that way. It doesn't work if you've got juries basing decisions on what the governor is going to do. Before leaving, I don't want us to lose sight of the fact that there are two specific issues in this case. One involves this particular instruction. I've been arguing here all this time on the assumption that the entire issue of commutation should not be before the jury, whether we're talking about death commutation or life without parole commutation. Right? We are faced with this particular statute, and I ask the court to bear that in mind. This is a statute which involves partial disclosure, neither more nor less. The jury is told that life without parole does not mean life without parole, period. They are not told that death does not mean death, even though death clearly does not mean death.
Did the defendant request an instruction like that?
State law prohibited the defendant from requesting.
Well, wasn't it possible after the enactment of this initiative that a reasonable lawyer might think that state law would change in that regard?
I don't know what the federal constitutional significance of that reasonable possibility is. If we're talking about, certainly there's no procedural default here.
Ordinarily, you can't complain about the failure to give an instruction, which you didn't request. If you say, this would have been a fine instruction if they just added to it this little part that I've now dreamed up. But if you didn't ask the trial court for that, you can't complain about it.
Well, I think if I take the thrust of your question correctly, what you're really talking about is a procedural default and failing to, in essence, object at trial. The California Supreme Court has reached the issue on the merits in this case. There's no issue. Whatever shortcoming of state law and state procedure there may have been in failing to tender this instruction to the jury has been forgiven by the California Supreme Court. There's no obstacle to this court's going on and reaching it. I ask the court to bear in mind that the California Supreme Court has stated flat out that if this were if we were dealing with a provision here which were a provision of an installment sales contract for the purchase of an automobile, and it were before a municipal court somewhere in the state of California, that court would be required to strike it down. This is the equivalent of telling somebody, I have two automobiles to sell. I want you to know that one of them has a cracked engine block, not disclosing that the other one also has a cracked engine block. There's nothing more nor less than this. And I suggest that if it's not good enough for a municipal court in the state of California, it oughtn't to be good enough in a death case before the highest court in the land. The other thing that I guess needs to be mentioned, although I don't think more can be done about it than mention it, is that there is a procedural problem in this case. I think there is a serious question about the court, about the security of the court's jurisdiction in this case. There is a ruling on the merits of a state law issue in this case contained in footnote 22 of the court's opinion. It's the last issue briefed in our brief on the merits, in which the California Supreme Court has ruled flatly that there was an error of state law in this case under California Evidence Code Section 352 in the admission of certain highly prejudicial error. Basically statements of the defendant that he might seek revenge on the jurors. But the California Supreme Court has ruled under California evidence law with there's no federal constitutional question there, that this was erroneously admitted. It should not be repeated at retrial. And they did not go on and reach the question of whether that error, standing by itself and without regard to the federal constitutional question, would require reversal. I suggest it's a very serious error.
Did that just go to the
It went to the penalty phase. Strictly to penalty, yes. And the California Supreme Court purported to predicate its decision on the federal constitution and therefore did not address the question of whether this error standing by itself would mandate reversal of the penalty phase. And in a situation like that, I've suggested in the brief that this court cannot feel secure that the petitioner has met his burden of demonstrating not only that that the California Supreme Court predicated its decision on a federal constitutional ground, but that ground was necessary to the decision.
Suppose we agreed with you, what would you suggest?
Well, the two options that this Court's cases have followed in that situation is either to dismiss the writ as having been improvidently granted or to vacate the opinion of the California Supreme Court and remand for a determination of whether the violation of California evidence law standing by itself would, and apart from any consideration, federal constitutional considerations, would require reversal of penalty.
Okay, well, do you have anything further, Mr. Mayfield?
Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. In regard to the jurisdictional question, the issue that the California Supreme Court found prejudicial evidence was bound up in the constitutional issue they were addressing. Prejudicial evidence, they found admitted, included the defendant's psychiatrist's testimony that the defendant himself knew about about the possibility of parole and was considering whether he might want to take revenge if he were paroled. In regard to amplifying instructions, the California Supreme Court did not find, and the statute does not provide, that a defendant, if he chose to do so, could not request additional amplifying instructions, whether they related to a disclaimer telling the jury not to consider the other instruction or an additional instruction about commutation of death penalty. The citation to Gardner versus Florida, that case is sort of the obverse of this case. That involved the instance where the sentencer, the judge, had some information that the defendant and his counsel didn't have and may have based his decision on that. Well, that was unfair. In this case, the information that the jury is given is information which the defendant knows, his counsel knows, and we are asked to find that it's unfair for the jury to know. In regard to a necessity for some prophylactic measure to offset this instruction to the jury, informing them that there is, in fact, a possibility of parole, I suggest that we have it in the requirements of the statute itself, which sets forth specific factors for the jury to consider and permits them to return a death penalty only if they find aggravating factors outweigh mitigating factors. And I suggest that this instruction is not about commutation anyway. What it's about is about the indisputable fact that this sentence, which is described as life imprisonment without the possibility of parole, which by its description has parole in it, that this sentence is in fact not a sentence that has no possibility of parole, and that's what the subject of the instruction is.
I just want to say that the sentence is not true.
That's correct.
As a statute that is not true, a valid statute.
I'm not saying that the sentence is. I'm saying that there is a possibility of parole, and I'm saying yes, the statute is valid, and particularly if jurors are made aware of the fact of what this alternative sentence is. The jurors are not told to speculate as to when the defendant might be paroled. They're specifically told to consider these factors and determine whether aggravating circumstances outweigh mitigating circumstances.
Mr. Mayfield, may I go back to the jurisdictional point for a moment? The testimony that was erroneously admitted, as I remember, was the psychiatrist's testimony that this defendant had said that if his sentence is commuted, he might seek revenge against the prosecutor, the judge, and the jury. Was that what he said, something like that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, and your view is that even though that's a matter of state law, an error of state law, it would presumably be harmless error? Is that your thought? Why wouldn't that be a sufficient reason for reversing the conviction?
What I'm saying is that the reason it was found to be erroneous, the California Supreme Court said it was this instruction.
Because the instruction emphasized the fact that the sentence might be commuted, isn't it?
It says the instruction permitted this evidence to be introduced. They found that the mere mention.
Well, but I'm not quite clear on what your response is. The jurisdictional argument that your opponent makes is that, well, this is clearly an error of state law. The California Supreme Court has told us that. And it's rather obviously a fairly significant error because it suggests to the jury that they ought to sentence the man to death in order to protect themselves, and that therefore the judgment would have been reversed on state law grounds even if they're wrong about the federal constitution. And if that's true, then we don't have jurisdiction. Now, what's your response to the argument?
My response to that is that the error they found on state law grounds was error because of the conclusion that the instruction regarding the possibility of parole was erroneous on federal constitutional grounds.
Well, that may be true, but it's still ultimately a state law ground as to the erroneously admitted evidence, isn't it?
No, Your Honor, it is not.
Oh, I see.
Because the reason it was erroneously admitted was because of the ruling on the federal constitutional error.
You're not suggesting that it would have been harmless error. Let me just be sure I get that to one side.
I'm suggesting that if it's on state law, if it's strictly state law grounds, then under the state law, the California Supreme Court would have to examine the evidence and determine that a miscarriage of justice occurred.
If this were remanded, as your colleague suggests, or if we ruled that there's an adequate and independent state ground, I take it that would be on the basis there's going to be a new trial. And I suppose the new trial would go forward without this instruction, since the state Supreme Court has ruled that the instruction is unconstitutional.
Yes, it would.
And if the new trial went forward and the state lost, the federal issue would be foreclosed, I suppose.
That's correct. If there were a new trial, then in all cases the California Supreme Court's ruling.
But in any event, you say that without the federal constitutional ruling, which you say is erroneous, the state court would never have made this evidentiary ruling.
I don't go that far. I say that the evidentiary ruling, the finding of prejudice, is so bound up in the federal constitutional ruling that we can't say that there's an independent state ground.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Jones.